Welcome to Moments with Marianne. This is your host, Marianne Pastana. And we're here today with special guest, Dr. Jude Kuravan, who's here to share with us her new book, The Story of Gaia, The Big Breath and the Evolutionary Journey of Our Conscious Planet. Now, many of you know Dr. Jude Kuravan. She's a cosmologist, futurist, planetary healer, and previously one of the most senior businesswomen in the UK. She has a master's degree in physics from Oxford University and a doctorate in archaeology. She has traveled extensively, worked with wisdom keepers from many traditions, and is a strong, lifelong researcher of the nature of reality. She has authored 6 books, including The Cosmic Hologram, and is a member of the Evolutionary Leaders Circle. Today, we're going to dive into the evolutionary journey of our conscious planet. So let's welcome to the show Dr. Jude Kuravan.
Marianne, thank you. It's lovely to be with you again.
Well, thank you, Dr. Kuravan. It has been such an honor to have you back here again. I mean, your book contained so much information, I really felt like we needed a more in-depth conversation. And I'd like to start with the Big Breath. I know a lot of people have heard about the Big Bang, but I believe they'd be fairly new to the term the Big Breath. So can you share with us what that is?
Well, exactly. I mean, I suspect that most of our listeners, and certainly myself and likely yourself, were taught at school that our universe began, the best estimate we now have was 13.8 billion years ago, in a Big Bang. And, you know, that's very evocative because what does a bang mean? Well, a bang sort of implies chaos and explosion and all the rest of it. And we know that big it wasn't. It was the most minute point it's ever been. Our universe began as a minute part of space and time. But, you know, it wasn't begun in a bang. Instead, it was begun in an incredibly ordered and fine-tuned way, in such a way that ever since then, as space has continued to expand and time has flowed forward from that first moment, it's been able to undertake an evolutionary journey from simplicity to ever greater levels of complexity because of that incredible level of fine-tuning and relationships between all the forces that we call the laws of physics. So instead of describing the beginning as a Big Bang, I talk of it being the first moment of an ongoing Big Breath. And again, some of our listeners may be aware that the ancient traditions, especially of ancient India, talk about our universe being an out-breath, a breath of the creator god Brahman. So we now know, as cosmologists, as scientists, that indeed our universe is this incredible out-breath from that first moment 13.8 billion years ago, all the way till now and ongoing. And for me, and I'd love to hear your sense of this, describing our universe as a big breath really brings us back to our own breath, how we breathe. And when we relate to our universe in this way, it's almost as though the universe is breathing through us. So I wrote it like this because it just had this aha moment for so many people, but also it's the best evidence we have of how our universe does exist and evolve.
I think that has to be one of the best descriptions I've ever heard of that. And it's interesting when we look at it from at least from my vantage point, when I look at it from a big breath view, there's this consciousness of we're all intertwined. It's not the planet is separate from us, from the animals and the foliage, nothing like that. We're all combined.
Exactly. I mean, in the book, I talk about, you know, and I've done other pieces of this, how everything breathes. You know, people breathe, plants breathe, planets breathe, and our entire universe in this sense breathes. It's such a profound relationship. And of course, the other thing about breath, and again, reverting to the ancient Indian tradition, the word for breath is prana, but it's also the same word for spirit. So it's a sense of, you know, the consciousness of our universe, the innate sentience, the innate intelligence of a living and evolving universe is this great whole beingness of a big breath.
What do you want our readers and our listeners to take away from understanding the big breath? I know we've covered quite a bit, but it seems that there's just so much more to that.
Well, what it does, of course, is it completely turns the old paradigm of our understanding of the nature of our universe and of reality on its head. Because, you know, the old paradigm, the old scientific-based paradigm, however, talks about, you know, a universe that is essentially without meaning, bereft of purpose, where everything essentially is an initial accident and then continues through random processes, somehow, after all this enormous amount of time, to form planets and plants and people, you know, where consciousness somehow arises quite far into, very far into this process. And it's a worldview of materialism and of separation. As you say, it's, you know, it separates us from each other, our planetary home, our whole universe. And now scientific breakthroughs and discoveries of the last few years especially, and at all scales of existence, from the tiniest to the whole universe, and across many fields of research, including biology and planetary sciences and systems analysis of human collective behaviors, as well as physics and cosmology and chemistry and all the other stuff, are turning that on its head. And instead of which, they're revealing that our universe exists and evolves, meaningfully exists and purposefully evolves as a unified entity, where in its wholeness, it is what's called non-locally unified, which means that it both exists and evolves as a whole being, and yet within space and time, it differentiates itself into individual expressions of its innate intelligence, because that's the other thing. Our universe is being revealed as being innately intelligent. It's being shown to be rather a great thought, rather than a great thing, and crucially, where mind and consciousness aren't, as the old paradigm suggests, something we have and something that has, you know, accidentally evolved, but what we and the whole world are. And what that does, in my view and my hope, is it transforms our relationships with ourselves, with each other, with our planetary home, with the whole universe and the entire cosmos, because it shows that we belong. You know, we don't have to be invited into some sort of relationship. And certainly it transforms the understanding of its appearance of separation as being essentially illusory. It literally invites us to wake up and remember that we're inseparable.
In your book, you talk about how the universe is this two-dimensional holographic boundary in many places that we call space. What do you mean by that?
Well, when we, you know, have you ever tried solving a Rubik's Cube puzzle?
Yes, and not successfully. I'm not one of those people.
Well, I'm not very good at it either. But what we're finding now is as if our universe was a Rubik's Cube, and we're now discovering all of the pieces that are, you know, like the cubes within a bigger Rubik's Cube, they're all connected with each other. And if you do turn, 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 some people can do it about 6 seconds or less, you can solve the Rubik's puzzle. So there are a number of features, a number of discoveries that have happened over the last period of time, really, that are revealing that the appearance of our universe, its energy and matter and space, time, are not its fundamental reality, but that literally emerge out of deeper non-physical realms of intention and causation and intelligence. But one of the key aspects of how that comes to be is what you just referred to, which is what's called the holographic principle. And the reason it's called that is that in a hologram, in a human hologram, certainly the older versions of it, the original versions of it, if you take a beam of light and you split that beam and you focus part of that beam on an object. It could be an apple, it could be anything. The reflected light back brings a lot of information about that object. When that light, that information is then combined with the other part of the light beam, it creates a two-dimensional pattern of information. So an apple, we see an apple, the appearance of an apple is three-dimensional. The appearance of our universe is three-dimensional. But what a hologram does, it shows us that if we shine light of what we perceive as a three-dimensional object, we can collect all of its information on a two-dimensional surface in a pattern of information that describes that object. Now, if we aim a beam of light through that holographic pattern, a hologram of that original object is projected. So from that two-dimensional pattern of information, a three-dimensional hologram, appearance of a three-dimensional hologram that is the appearance of that original object is projected. You can walk around it. You know, in London now we have ABBA, my favorite group, ABBA, as a holographic concert. You know, it's quite extraordinary, the technology. But taking that technology in that way, that you can create a three-dimensional hologram from a two-dimensional pattern of information. When we were looking at black holes in space, the question was asked, well, what happens to a star, which at the end of its life, a massive star, which at the end of its life runs out of its nuclear fuel and starts to collapse in on itself? If it's big enough, if it's massive enough, the gravity is so strong that it can't hold back that continuing collapse. And the star literally collapses to a point where not even light can escape. And that threshold, that point beyond which light can't escape, is called the event horizon of a black hole. And because light can't escape, that's why we call a black hole a black hole, because beyond that event horizon, there is just the appearance of blackness. But the key question then was, well, what happens to all the information about that star when it collapses to a black hole? And it was realized that, first of all, the information isn't lost, but vitally and crucially, that instead of being equivalent or proportional to the three-dimensional volume of a black hole, because, of course, stars are spherical. When they collapse as spherical entities. So an event horizon of a black hole is the surface of a sphere. But what was discovered was the information of that star isn't proportional to the three-dimensional volume of a black hole, but to its two-dimensional surface area of the event horizon. Now, what does that remind you of? And I hope you're going to say a hologram.
Well, you took the words right out of my mouth, a hologram.
Fantastic. So realizing that, it was also realized that if we scale that perception up to the whole universe, and a lot of other pieces of evidence were sort of plugging into the Rubik's Cube at this point that suggested this. But the suggestion was that our entire universe is a holographic projection from a two-dimensional boundary of that we call space-time. And since that initial proposal decades now ago, more and more evidence has come to suggest that that's exactly how our universe, or the appearance of our universe, is manifested, which is why I wrote a book called The Cosmic Hologram a little while ago to, you know, show all of the evidence for this. And since that book came out in, 2017, it's not my latest book, you know, more and more and more evidence has mounted up to say, this is very much what looks to be the case for our universe.
So how does the Milky Way have a connection to the Earth?
Well, the Milky Way is our galaxy. You know, our Milky Way is, as are the billions upon billions of galaxies throughout our universe, home to, again, billions and billions of stars. So right from the very beginning of our universe, 13.8 billion years ago, after a period of time where space was expanding and cooling down, and the very earliest matter and energy were coming into form, stars and galaxies began to form. And there's still a lot of active investigation on the processes of that. But the very earliest stars were huge compared to our sun. And of course, with space being much smaller then, they're much closer together. So we're now realizing, and the best new evidence coming from the James Webb Telescope is suggesting that within 200 to 300 million years of the beginning of our universe, from that first moment of the Big Breath, the very early stars and very early galaxies were coming into being, and possibly the very first black holes were coming into being, because these stars, when they came to the end of their lives, they lived much shorter lives. They either became black holes or exploded their matter to form new generations of stars. But those very earliest stars likely formed the massive, supermassive black holes we're now finding at the center of most, if not all, of the galaxies we're studying. So our galaxy, again, is a very old galaxy. Our galaxy might have been one of the first to form. And it's now 120,000 light years across with a supermassive central black hole. And we're about, our solar system is about two-thirds of the way out from the center. And our solar system and our star came into being around just over 5 billion years ago. So our Milky Way galaxy was already pretty middle-aged by the time our sun and our solar system and our planetary home, Gaia, came into being.
Are there a lot of Gaia-sized planets out there?
There sure are. I mean, we're still, again, the study of what's called exoplanets, in other words, planetary systems and planets beyond our own solar system, is still reasonably new science, but it's expanding so greatly. So we've now identified well over 1,000 what are called exoplanets, and some of them are the size of Gaia, and some of them are in what we call the Goldilocks zone, which is the distance from their star where liquid water can survive, and it seems to be watery planetary homes that can then nurture further complexity of biological organisms such as ourselves. But, you know, life will find a way if it can. And all the building blocks of biological life were already in what we call interstellar molecular clouds of dust and gas as birthing clouds before our planetary home and planetary system came into being. And we're finding such interstellar dust clouds as birthing clouds throughout our galaxy and likely throughout all galaxies. But the other thing is that when planetary systems form, they seem to form with multiple planets. So we now are coming to the understanding that there are likely more planets in our galaxy than there are stars. But also those building blocks of biological life, if there's liquid water, it doesn't have to be a whole planet such as ours. We now are looking to the possibility that not only might there have been biological life on Mars in the early days of our solar system, and even perhaps on Venus, but there might still be underneath the ice crusts of moons, some of the moons of Jupiter and Saturn in our own solar system.
Well, that's definitely exciting when you hear about it that way. It's like, ooh, we've got so much to explore and to look at. There's just so much adventure to be had there.
It is an adventure, isn't it? And it's the most extraordinary story. I mean, we go back to that first moment, so the Big Breath, 13.8 billion years ago, and our universe was not only the smallest it's ever been, but it was also the simplest it's ever been. And yet within that simplicity, within the relationships, within that simplicity of the laws of physics and the fine tuning I mentioned earlier, the level of order, from those very earliest moments of just, you know, hydrogen, nuclear, you know, the nucleons of hydrogen and some helium a little bit of lithium, hundreds of millions of years before then stars formed. Nonetheless, everything was there to start this evolutionary process from simplicity to ever greater levels of emergence and complexity and individuation that led eventually to planets and to us.
Now, does Gaia have, in better terms, I'm sure you'll come up with, but parents, so to speak, the planetary parents?
Yeah, I like to consider our entire solar system as a solar family. And I write solar, not in the S-O-L-A-R, but solar with a U, so S-O-U-L-A-R, as essentially a family of living evolution, of consciousness evolution. So in that regard, you know, the sun, sol, our moon, Luna, could be considered the parents of Gaia. And, you know, the other planets as Gaia's siblings. And there's good reason for that, because our entire solar family does indeed exist and evolve together with profound resonances between the orbits of the different planets. You know, this beautiful Goldilocks zone where we are, not too hot, not too cold, able to be a watery planet, but also our star, you know, our sun, giving us that level of radiance that is just perfect for Gaia to be able to nurture this ongoing complexity of life, and for our moon to be the perfect size. And there's a story to this, which we can go into more, but the right size and the right distance to, again, through the tidal relationships, to act as a sort of a churner of nutrients to offer the greatest level of environmental opportunities within Gaia's own story as a planetary mother.
I've always been fascinated how we're always in that Goldilocks zone. We're not too hot, we're not too cold. You know, it would be so easy for our planet to be off a little bit one way or another, and things wouldn't be the way that they are.
Absolutely. And, you know, it does look as though in the early days of our solar family that Mars and likely Venus were also watery planets, because when we look out at these interstellar clouds that I mentioned earlier, they are full of ice. You know, so water is present there, and crucially so, as then are all of the, you know, what we call prebiotic, these complex carbon-based molecules that are the building blocks of organic life, you know, of amino acids that go on to form protons, the forerunners of the genetic codes of DNA and RNA, the sort of the oiliness of lipids, which enables our cells to have membranes, and things like sugars, which, of course, are for energy. So all those building blocks we've now discovered exist, and we've measured them, exist in those interstellar clouds of dust. So when our solar family was born, the planets again embodied, certainly the rocky planets, the inner rocky planets, such as Gaia, Mars, Venus, and likely Mercury, although Mercury is so close to the sun, it wouldn't have lasted very long at all, but had a lot of water, a lot of initially ice, and then potentially water. And there was also a lot of ice in asteroids and comets in the middle and outer parts of our solar family. And, you know, those impacts in those early years of our planetary system brought yet more, if there was need, even more water to these rocky inner planets. And so our planet, our planetary home, Gaia, has been a water planet virtually from the very beginning.
I know in your book you talk about DNA. So we talk about the DNA of the planet, and how does that relate to our DNA?
Well, I don't so much speak of the DNA of the planet, because for me, our entire planetary home, Gaia, has this interconnected intelligence, but it's not in the form of biological DNA other than in her biological children, such as ourselves. But her intelligence is actually embodied in what I call her entire Gaia sphere. So the rocks and the minerals of her geosphere, the waters of her hydrosphere, the air of her atmosphere, and the biological intelligence of her biosphere. But what is the case is those harbingers, those really first, you know, steps towards the genetic templates that are embodied in DNA and RNA molecules, A, were already there in those interstellar dust clouds, but also from the very earliest ability of Gaia to take those next steps to complexity and the birth of biological organisms, DNA was right first time. The same DNA that was embodied in the earliest biological organisms is in our DNA today. RNA, which is very much more of a messenger aspect of information. Again, you know, different forms of RNA actually undertake different processes of intelligent information sharing. But again, they got, you know, are the intelligence of our universe, the intelligence of Gaia, got that right first time. And right in an incredible sense, because recent analyses of DNA have shown that it's by far the most effective way of both holding information and sharing information. And as I say, it was right from the very earliest forms of biological life all the way up to us now.
Thank you for taking the time to go through that. And I really appreciate that, because there's so much there. And it kind of has me wondering, I know in your book, you talk about just this, how our universe has this innate intelligence, and how it's just inherently alive, and that we are, in many ways, this is a multidimensional awareness that exists here. And I'd love for you to kind of expand on that for our listeners.
Thank you. And isn't it an amazing, wonderful adventure? And it invites us into that adventure, because we are, literally are, the microcosmic co-creators of our universe. You know, we talk about we're made from stardust, and indeed we are. You know, what happens inside stars is that as they go through their nuclear fuel, that the beginning of stars is pretty much hydrogen, some helium, very important, some lithium. But the whole process when a star forms, it then goes through this wonderful alchemy of called nucleosynthesis, where those initial simple chemicals or elements are transmuted into ever more complex elements. And most of that takes place within stars, but some of it, really clever stuff, actually takes place beyond stars, or within stars that combine. You know, the gold of the universe was created, we think now, in terms of two aged but huge, powerful stars colliding and creating such incredible levels of energy, that gold was sort of formed from that, alchemized from that. So we've got this story of this elemental progression to complexity in stars. And there are 94 natural elements. 61 of those are what we call biological elements. In other words, we find them in biological beings. So what this journey does is show us, first of all, that the hydrogen in the water and in other molecules in our bodies, and hydrogen is very pervasive, was created in the very first moments of our entire universe. We're not just as old as stars, we're as old as the entire universe. So the story of our universe is our story. We belong, we've accompanied, the potential of us has accompanied this incredible story for 13.8 billion years. So not just does our breath, you know, is a sense of the universe breathing through us, but everything that makes up our human experience is ultimately universal. And because our universe exists and evolves, as you say, Marianne, as a sort of a multidimensional being of intelligence, we too are multidimensional, and we have innate abilities to commune, to connect with, to engage with, communicate with our entire universe and its multidimensional intelligence naturally.
I know you've done so much research for this book. What were the first organisms to really evolve that we're aware of?
Well, the first sort of, if you like, the easiest way of describing this is the first single-celled beings. And as they emerge, and very early on in Gaia's story, I mean, it may be that she solidified, came into being, and pretty much very early on as a water planet, close on 4 billion years ago. And by 3.8 billion years ago, it may well have been that those very, very earliest of our ancestors were born. Yeah, but the thing is, the information was already there in those interstellar dust clouds. It was, the whole of our universe has been on this evolutionary journey from the very beginning. So what we see is often a situation where things get ready. They get ready for then an opportunity to take onto the next level of complexity and evolution and emergence. So when we are into this very, very earliest epoch of Gaia as a planetary home, as a planetary mother, we find these very, very earliest of cells. But, by then, and thanks to the interstellar dust clouds hundreds of millions of years before, they were able to form a cell, in other words, that was able to differentiate itself from its environment. And in a membrane, its membrane that surrounded it, to essentially decide what to let through and what to say, no, thank you, I don't want that within me. And over time, different types of these first single-celled organisms began to develop further skills, various abilities. So one learned how to form energy, to actually take the energy of our sun and use it for its own purposes. Now, over time, another form of single-celled life actually formed a relationship, a symbiotic relationship with that one who figured out how to, use energy. Now, that one is now what we call mitochondria. And mitochondria continue to fuel our cells and therefore our bodies billions of years later. So what you have is relationships at every scale from that very, very earliest moment. But those relationships are collaborative. Sometimes they're competitive, but with each onward step of the journey from simplicity to complexity has featured cooperation. So, those mitochondria ultimately formed a symbiotic cooperative relationship with the organisms that ingested them. We have this story time and time and time again. At one point, another tiny organism found a way of photosynthesizing sun's energy, green-blue algae. Now, those blue-green algae and their ability to photosynthesize now fuels all the plants, or pretty much all the plant kingdom of Gaia. And of course, all the animals of Gaia, ultimately, in the whole of the sort of chain of complexity, it begins with animals eating plants. So Gaia's continuing evolution features innately collaborative relationships at all scales. But as simplicity has moved to ever greater complexity, so has that complexity of cooperation shown the way forward.
I love that. I think that is just such a great great way of explaining that, and it makes so much sense. And in your book, you talk about the biosphere's tree of life. So yeah. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, it's more a bush. Insofar that the original sort of sense of a tree of life was that, you know, from its roots, from its ancient roots, a trunk, a sort of species evolved, and then they diversified just as the branches of a tree diversifies. But we now appreciate that earlier sense of a tree has needed to be modified quite a bit. And in fact, the very earliest views of biologists were that, you know, us and complex animals were sort of the higher branches of the tree. But we now realize that we're a tiny part of Gaia's biosphere and that complexity of the biosphere, that, you know, in terms of the overall biomass and the number of species and the complexity, you know, bacteria, viruses, fungi are very, very much more prevalent than we are. But of course, what Gaia has so incredibly done is nurture the evolution from innate simplicity to ever greater complexity. But essentially, with complexity comes a reduced level of flexibility. In other words, when we look at bacteria, when we look at fungi, when we look at plants, when we look at viruses, they're able to be much more flexible in their bodily systems and the way they relate and the way they can not only reproduce, but the way they can heal themselves in many ways than we can. What we have traded off for flexibility, we've traded up in terms of our complexity and our self and our individuation of our self-awareness. And that's an ongoing story. So it's not an either or, it's a both and. You know, Gaia's incredible abundance of life and of intelligence and innate sentience is expressed in so many different ways and is expressed throughout her Gaiasphere as it is within her biosphere.
In your book, you talk about photosynthesis of plants and how this has raised oxygen levels. And again, I look at all these coincidences, and maybe they're not coincidences, but as small miracles. Because if we didn't have enough oxygen, then there would be no atmosphere that we would be able to survive in.
Absolutely. And you know, the earliest atmosphere as Gaia was not oxygen at all. It was methane, it was carbon dioxide, it was others. We would have not survived. We could not have even begun to breathe in that early planetary atmosphere, but it was perfect for that time because it began the process, those continued processes of evolutionary complexity. So the bacteria of that time were able to breathe the atmosphere of that time. But after hundreds of millions of years, billions of years, the evolutionary process could only go so far because the atmosphere of methane and of carbon dioxide doesn't fuel the sort of the energy requirements of more complex organisms. Yeah. And so there was a process called the Great Oxygenation Event, which was when in-breathing organisms that breathe in carbon dioxide breathe out oxygen. And that's the photosynthesis that we're talking about. That's what plants do. But as a result of that, through, again, a whole process of transformation, Gaia's atmosphere was transformed from that initial atmosphere that would be completely toxic to subsequent organisms into one that was far, you know, that became an oxygenated atmosphere. So alongside that was a requirement for Gaia to evolve organisms that could in-breathe oxygen. Now, the other thing of that is that oxygen is a toxin. It can strip other elements. And so as part of that evolution, those organisms had not only to learn how to breathe in oxygen, they had to learn to for it to stop destroying their bodies. And that's when you got this next level of complexity. From cells that didn't have a central nucleus to cells that did have a central nucleus, which is pretty much all our cells, except our red blood cells. So what that allowed is a greater complexity of a cell. So within the cell, you had this mitochondria, which was the oxygen creator, of energy. But the other parts of the cell had to protect themselves from the oxygen. And that's when the DNA of the cells chose to surround itself by a membrane, became a nucleus of a cell. And that enabled the next level of complexity. So it's an incredible story of opportunism, of sheer ingenuity, genius, as to how Gaia and the universe, but as Gaia as a planetary home, was able to undertake each of these next steps of complexity that required an incredible level of informed, intelligent, relational development.
There's just so much to unpack there. And I am really trying to search for the right words to use here. I mean, because we in your book, you talk about how then mammals come, and that they're here and they're, we've got birds and everything's living alongside each other. So at what point does this type of evolution take place where we're moving more from the cellular point to actual biology, physiology of a being?
Well, it's happening all the time. I mean, we still have, the majority of Gaia's biosphere now is still single-celled organisms. Bacteria, and in fact, viruses are not even single-celled. They sort of went a route from initial simplicity to ever greater simplicity, but on a communal level. We still have, of course, with plants, we now are really beginning to understand, how sophisticated plant systems are, even without, animals, mammals, insects, whatever. But the plants themselves have an incredible level of complexity and communication abilities through many of them, through the what's called the mycelium network of fungi. And, 500 million years ago, fungi and plants entered into this relationship where, plants will photosynthesize and provide energy to fungi, and fungi, discover and bring to the plants nutrients from the soil. So there's that two-way relationship that is so prevalent, it's all collaborative. Sometimes it's competitive, but many times it is a sort of cooperative relationship that benefits the whole, whether that's a plant or an entire ecosystem or the entire Gaiasphere of Gaia. So the evolution's progressing all the time, but at various points, certain organisms and certain relationships are so beautifully balanced that they prevail for millions, if not tens, if not hundreds of millions of years. But the whole time, this journey from simplicity to ever greater complexity has emerged ever more, if you like, individuated self-awareness, awareness of our interdependence, awareness of ultimately our interbeing. So for us now, it's not so much a point of our biological evolution, it's about our evolution of consciousness. Because, we've had a worldview, certainly the last few hundred years, a couple of hundred years, a worldview of materialism and separation. So we're now, with all the science, as well as the understanding, the ancient traditions, universal wisdom traditions, are coming together to reveal that we are who we really are, that we are these microcosmic co-creators of the evolutionary impulse of our entire universe and our planetary home. So what does that invite us to?
That's a very good question. Well, and you know, by perceiving Gaia as a sentient being, I mean, that really, and we start our discussion with this, it really shifts our viewpoint of how we view the planet, and especially when we look at it as a conscious planet. And I think a lot of times people have a hard time making that connection with, like, what is a conscious planet?
You're absolutely right. But I do feel it's vital if we are to really, if we are to consciously evolve, healing our relationships, you know, with ourselves, with each other, with our planetary home, with our entire universe, is fundamental to that. So instead of a worldview of separation, to wake up with the evidence, as well as the ancient traditions, the universal traditions, the indigenous traditions that tell us this, to realize that we are inseparable and that fundamentally mind and consciousness aren't something we have. As I mentioned, they're what we and the whole world literally are. You know, we didn't really get into it in depth earlier, but, you know, I was talking about the appearance of our universe emerging from deeper levels of non-physical realms of intelligence and intention and causation. And we're finding this now at all scales of existence. So the energy matter, the appearance of the energy matter of our universe and the space-time of our universe is being realized to be as real, but is not that fundamental levels of causations that instead cosmic, we might want to call it, universal, we might want to call it, intelligence arises as meaningful, crucially meaningful information that informs the entirety of the appearance of our universe. So when we start to grapple, and it is a grappling, it's turning our old, you know, view of reality on its head, and yet all the evidence and all the wisdom is converging in this direction. When we turn that on our heads, you know, to realize that we are meaningful, we are purposeful co-creators of our universe's evolutionary impulse, it changes our relationship. And that, I think, also invites us then to that realization, that experiential realization that we are relations of our planetary home, Gaia, and that we can learn from her and all her children. And for me, healing our relationship with Gaia and all her children is fundamental to how we heal our relationships with ourselves, because this is who we really are. And this is how we might, if we're able to do this, how we may accept the invitation of our universe and Gaia to consciously evolve.
Well, Jude, I learned so much from your book, The Story of Gaia. Where can our listeners connect with you and be part of your community and learn more about your work?
Thank you, Marianne. And I'm so thrilled. I'm wholeheartedly delighted, you know, because it seems that, and a lot of folks are saying this, that in a way, and I'd love your sense of this, you don't read the book reads you. It's almost as though Gaia is reading you and inviting you into this adventure of this realization of this profound relationship with her and the entire universe. So yes, folks can reach me and our growing community at Whole World View, which is www.whole-world-view.org. And in there, there's lots of resources, lots of YouTubes, lots of invitations to sort of, you know, we talk about acting local, feeling global, thinking cosmic, and an invitation to sign up to our quarterly newsletter. And you know, just an invitation to and a welcome to this adventure and this journey, I hope, of all of us, of homecoming to who we really are and who we can evolve to become.
Well, Dr. Jude Kuravan, thank you so much for taking the time to be on the show with us here today.
Oh, Marianne, as always, it's such a huge pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Dr. Jude Curvan. It has been such an honor to spend this time with you and to talk about your new book, The Story of Gaia. The Story of Gaia is available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and all indie retailers. And of course, remember to support our indie bookstores. If you don't see it on the shelf there, ask for them to order it. You can also purchase the book at the publisher, Inner Traditions, at innertraditions.com. Make sure to visit Dr. Jude Curvan's website at judecurvan, and that's spelled CURRIVAN.com. There she has listed great information, links you can follow, and also information to her books. Well, we're going to pause here for a quick moment, and we'll be right back after this message. I'd like to thank Jason Eastwood at Guitarfulness for sharing his inspiring music and talent with us. His music is known worldwide for cultivating atmospheres of harmony, inner peace, and clarity. Visit Jason's website at guitarfulness.com. Join his newsletter, be part of his community, and download his music. Well, we're at the end of our time today. I'd like to thank everyone for tuning in. You've been listening to Moments with Marianne, where we make every moment count.
In a single moment, your life can change. Moments with Marianne is a transformative hour that covers an endless array of topics with the best of the best. Her guests are leaders in their fields, ranging from inspirational authors, top industry leaders, and business and spiritual entrepreneurs. Each guest is gifted and a true visionary, a recognized leader in her own work, and while teaching others to develop, refocus, and grow, Marianne will bring the best guest and sometimes a special surprise. Don't miss this. You never know just which moment will change your life forever. Make sure to tune in and visit MomentsWithMarianne.com for more information.